It's my first time getting back up and teaching here in a little while, and so maybe a little shaky for different reasons, but sometimes you come across texts. Chris, if you could go ahead and give me that first. Come across texts that are troubling or difficult to teach through in the sense that they seem kind of abstract, that it's hard to discern how they connect in any way with life in our world, that it's hard to understand how God might speak through them. But that's not the case with this one, or wasn't my experience with this one. That instead it was troubling in the sense that it seemed to have an immediate application, that it seemed to speak very directly into some of the situations that we see in the world around us, spoke directly to my heart, that God had a message in and through this story for me and for me to share with all of you. And so I'm going to do my best to pass that along. But first we'll go ahead and read the story of Cain and Abel. The man Adam knew his wife Eve intimately. She became pregnant and gave birth to Cain and said, "I have given life to a man with the Lord's help." She gave birth a second time to Cain's brother Abel. Abel cared for the flocks, and Cain farmed the fertile land. Sometime later, Cain presented an offering to the Lord from the land's crops, while Abel presented his flock's oldest offspring with their fat. The Lord looked favorably on Abel and his sacrifice, but didn't look favorably on Cain and his sacrifice. Cain became very angry and looked resentful. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why do you look so resentful? If you do the right thing, won't you be accepted? But if you don't do the right thing, sin will be waiting at the door, ready to strike. It will entice you, but you must rule over it." Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." When they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. The Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" Cain said, "I don't know. Am I my brother's guardian?" The Lord said, "What did you do? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. You are now cursed from the ground that opened its mouth to take your brother's blood from your hand. When you farm the fertile land, it will no longer grow anything for you, and you will become a roving nomad on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is more than I can bear. Now that you've driven me away from the fertile land, and I am hidden from your presence, I'm about to become a roving nomad on the earth, and anyone who finds me will kill me." The Lord said to him, "It won't happen. Anyone who kills Cain will be paid back seven times." And the Lord put a sign on Cain so that no one who found him would assault him. And Cain left the Lord's presence, and he settled down in the land of Nod, east of Eden. So each time I'm preparing a teaching like this one, I normally try to approach the text in sort of a questioning, curious mode, not looking for an idea to take away yet, but looking for maybe details that I've missed before, trying not to hear it through a big picture lens yet. And I want to share some of these questions with you, because a lot of times those questions are what becomes kind of the impetus for some research and become kind of the structure of a teaching. But this time I had a very different experience with this. So some of the questions that came to mind reading this text: how had Adam and Eve not had a kid yet? Seems kind of weird that it waited to happen until after the Garden of Eden. Are the brothers twins, as some assume, or did one come? Is this a story of two separate births? Why did they choose the different professions that they chose, and how did they learn them? Why did they present offerings? What was the precedent for that? Why does God like one and not the other? How does God not get the connection between what happened and Cain's response? Is God being cruel, kind of poking an open wound with Cain? How was Cain supposed to know what the right thing to do was? How did Cain know what sin was? How was he supposed to know how to rule over it? Did Cain invite Abel out into the field with the intent to kill him? Once again, after this happens, is God just provoking Cain? Or are we being presented with a picture of a less than omniscient God, unsure of all of what is taking place within his creation? Who did Cain expect would find him after leaving the fertile land? Why is God offering protection for someone who's just committed murder? What was the sign? How is it supposed to warn people about Cain's status? How is it that Cain could leave God's presence? Was God only to be found within Eden? How does Cain settle somewhere else if he is supposed to be a nomad? The classic question that many people have raised, where did Cain get a wife? Who is the city that Cain went and built for? How are we supposed to take all, the origin stories come a little bit later. And then at the end of the chapter, it talks about people worshiping God for the first time. How are we supposed to understand the story of those sacrifices if God, the worship of God only begins with the end of the story? Unlike some of my other research for teaching and stuff, I was unable to answer any of these questions. Because, for the simple fact being that they are not found in the text. So you can certainly go and you can kind of hear different explanations, different ways that people have tried to fill in some of those gaps over the years. But the fact is that this story just reads as stark and sparse, spare in detail as it could possibly be. I think it's maybe Cormac McCarthy's first story. What we do know about some of the names are kind of interesting, that Cain's name comes from the sense that Eve had, who maybe is the only heroine of the story, that she is joining back in the work of co-creating with God, and that Abel's name seems to be a foreshadowing of his futile and brief life. We see the story kind of this progressive moving farther and farther away or out of Eden, and what that means, not just geographically, but symbolically. We see this mark being put on Cain, which is kind of strange. One suggestion that was given for this that I'm still kind of wrestling with, but I'll throw it out, is that the idea of vengeance, which I'm still not comfortable with God being the one carrying out necessarily, but the idea of vengeance was supposed to be the role of the family if someone was killed, and that this is in some strange and kind of dark and fallen way God's extension of God's family to Cain, even in his nomadic state. But in the end, we're left with more questions about this story than we have answers. And it might be exactly because of the lack of detail, the lack of answers to these questions, that some in our tradition, the New Testament writers included, felt able to borrow Cain and Abel, the figures of Cain and Abel, for various purposes. They use them often to symbolize good and evil, to stand in for every guilty or every innocent person through all time, and so on. So in 1 John 3:12, John writes, "Don't behave like Cain, who belonged to the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he kill him? He killed him because his own works were evil, but the works of his brother were righteous." Doing a little bit of reading between the lines, but a little within the limits of the story. Jesus even accesses this story, talking to some of the religious and political leaders in Luke 11. "How terrible for you. You built memorials to the prophets whom your ancestors killed. In this way, you testify that you approve of your ancestors' deeds. They killed the prophets, and you build memorials. Therefore, God's wisdom has said, 'I will send prophets and apostles, and they will harass and kill some of them. As a result, this generation will be charged with the murder of all the prophets since the beginning of time. This includes the murder of every prophet, from Abel to Zechariah, who was killed between the altar and the holy place. Yes, I'm telling you, this generation will be charged with it." So Jesus includes kind of liberally Abel as the first in the line of prophets, even though Abel didn't actually say or do much in the story, and draws this line all the way down to Zechariah and even himself as people who will be killed. Killed unfairly, unjustly. But none of these readings, none of these different things come from the text, but from a reading this story, trying to fill in some of the gaps in order to interpret it faithfully to a contemporary context. And I wonder if we can't do the same, if we can't read this story with all of its lingering questions and open-ended possibilities and ask ourselves, where do we see ourselves and others in this story? This seemed like a safe question to ask because it's one that I ask of most of our biblical texts, until you consider this. There are only two human players in this story. One of them lives and one of them dies. And we are all here. There are, however, those who lay dead today, who have been murdered not by any of us directly, but dead nonetheless, killed at the hands of a system that we are a part of in many ways. I've been overwhelmed recently by reading about the victims of particularly police shootings. I started combing through lists and was disturbed by the number of names, by the situations that were given surrounding these, by the ways that their story in so many ways seemed to echo Abel's. The story of Deborah Danner, of Larry Matthews, Dante Jones, Carnell Snell, Jaquarius Robinson, Najir Salam, Douglas Rainey, George Richards Meyer, Christopher Sowell, Alfred Alongo, Otis Colvin, Keith Scott, Terrence Crutcher, Tyree King, Markel Bivens, Terrence Sterling, Gregory Frazier, Bernard Cottrell, Randall Roddick, and we could keep going on and on. That list was just a portion of the black men and women, and it just goes back to the beginning of the month of September of this year. And I know that in many of these cases, these stories are complex and they're multi-layered and they're multifaceted, that there's many sides to the story and so on, but the thing that they seem to have in common with the story of Cain and Abel, and that can be said for certain, is this: that these men and women are children of God, created in the image of God, and that what happened to them was certainly not God's justice. That like Abel, their blood cries out from the ground as long as justice is not done. What is also often true is this, that in many of us end up then standing in Cain's position. We hear these stories, we know that something is wrong. We may feel some level of pain, anger, frustration, confusion, maybe just a more general sense that something is just not right in the world. And yet it's fairly often that we stand in Cain's position before God, asking, what does this have to do with me? Am I my brother's keeper? The frightening and sad reality about the Cain and Abel story is that it was not meant to be a one-time story. The reason this story rang true with others in our tradition and hopefully rings true with us is that it is an often repeated one. We know that the innocent will continue to be killed, that justice will continue to be left undone. And yet simultaneously we stand in Cain's place after the killing of his brother and yet given a new opportunity, a new call from God every day. We continue to face the call that Cain faced at the beginning of the story because sin continues to be the same. There is this predatory element coming in from the outside, but a recognition that it must have something to latch onto inside of us. That within Cain there was this resentment, anger, hatred of his brother. For us, maybe sometimes it looks more like apathy and despair in the face of injustice. That sin is able to latch onto, to make us complicit in these systems of injustice. In East of Eden, John Steinbeck explores God's final word to Cain before he takes Abel out into the field. The notion that sin wants to rule over you, but you, in Steinbeck's translation, may rule over it. In that reading of the text, we all face the same option. Not that we must have mastery over sin, it's not inevitable. As far as most people can tell, it's not even being put as a command from God in this story. but it reiterates the radical freedom that God has given to humanity. When sin is looking for something to latch onto within us, you may rule over it. When we are tempted to become hopeless, to despair in the face of ongoing injustice, when we are tempted to continue as a part of the injustices in our world, especially in our country, we may. We may throw our hands up in despair, go on living our lives as though we pretend that we don't see the things that are going on, live our lives within whatever privileges we've been afforded. Or we may choose to speak up, speak against injustice. We may choose to build relationships with those who are different than us in various ways, especially those of other races, as those relationships seem to be especially tense. Rather than to allow fear to divide us, we may reach out to our brothers and sisters, even in our own fellowship, and ask what we can do to offer support and comfort when they continue to be traumatized by the possibility of being killed unjustly in a way that the rest of us don't face. We may choose to remain silent when family and friends and coworkers perpetuate racist myths or express hatred even under more subtle guises, or we may choose to call them out. We may choose to learn more about the roots of this system. We may choose to learn more about why these things happen the way they do, about what leads up to these kinds of things. Or we can choose to remain ignorant. We may choose to let ourselves be numbed to them because of how often we see them. We may. Because it is our choice of how to respond to these things, a member of our own fellowship has a kind of specific, very concrete challenge that she wants to extend to us. I think she's already handed out the sheets, but I'm going to have Gail come up, and she's going to extend this particular challenge to us today.
Good morning, New Covenant. How are you? My name is Gail Ferguson, and I'm the wife of Oliver Ferguson, who is on the LT, if you don't know. And what Kai just shared is very personal to us, because we are Black. Now, that seems strange to say. Isn't it obvious? But if you've been raised by loving family and community that's taught you, look past race. It doesn't matter that we look different. We're all the same. If you are raised by a loving, colorblind philosophy, then you might not have noticed. It matters because for people who are Black in this country, the experiences that we have are very different. So even though we're all as valuable to God, the society communicates that Black lives don't matter quite as much. And so that's why there is a Black Lives Matter movement. This is a real situation in our country, and you know, the question some of us are asking is, what's our response as Christians to all of this? That's a question that Renee asked when she and I prayed about this. Because one day I was just so beside myself realizing that Oliver could be driving on the street, be pulled over for no reason. That my son is 3. He could go to the park with a stick in his hand and someone could call the police because they think it's a gun. This is real. But while praying with Renee, the Lord gave an idea. And so that's why I'm here. So I'm partnering with Kai and Kristen. And there's a larger cloud of people, Patty, Theo, Renee, on an idea. This is a way that we can be a part of God's justice in our country. It's our beloved country. We want to be here. And God has a role for us. God has a role for you and us together. And I really believe that this is for New Covenant, for now, for each of us. And so the idea has to do with the story of Esther. Let me remind you a little bit about Esther. This is a whole book of the Bible. There's a king called Xerxes, and he ruled over 127 provinces where Jews were scattered throughout. His wife that he selected, her name was Esther. She was a Jew unbeknownst to him. There was an official in his kingdom who decided that he had had enough of the Jews. And this is what the scripture says in Esther 3. Haman, this official, says, "There's a certain people. Their customs are different from those of all other people. It's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. Destroy them." That rings so true for many reasons. The annihilation of the Jews, the persecution of the Jews. Now we look at the annihilation of black people in this country. And so Mordecai, who is Esther's uncle, appeals to her that you are in the palace. Isn't there something that you might be able to do? And she's reluctant at first, because at that time you can be killed for simply approaching the king. You can't just do that. It's costly. And so this is what Mordecai says to her, and in praying about this, God gave me ideas to connect it to our situation. So if you have one of these, just pull it out and let me know. Can you see? Can you read? Is there enough light? Okay. If you didn't get one of these, you can just put your hand up and Oliver will help you too. There's some in the front, a couple people. Oliver will get you one. So Mordecai sent this reply to Esther. "Don't think for a moment that because you're in the palace, so she has privilege. How about your privilege? If you have white privilege, education, or wealth, then you're like Esther right now. You will escape when all the other Jews are killed. Well, if the lives of our black brothers and sisters continue to be stolen, then we will all come to ruin. 1 Corinthians says, if one part suffers, every part suffers with it." Mordecai continues, "If you keep quiet, now what would that be like for us? If we let that racist comment slide that we hear at work? If you avoid discussing race-related police violence because you just don't know what to say? If you shy away from listening to or responding to black people's lament at a rally? If you choose not to like that Facebook post because, you know, it's talking about just another shooting and you really don't want to get embroiled in that? Even though you agree that justice is needed, if you don't offer prayers for black lives, all of those things are keeping quiet for us right now. At a time like this," says Mordecai, "what's the time we're in the United States? Well, go read this piece, what the data really says about police and racial bias. Go and read the evidence, the statistics, if you're really not sure what's happening. What it shows is statistics about the fact that black people in this country are disproportionately targeted by police. And so it shows that issue." Mordecai continues, "Deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise. And we are reminded that God will again bring deliverance and relief for African Americans and other blacks in this country who continue to be oppressed here. And it will arise from some other place, but you and your relatives will die if you don't get involved." And that reminds us that we have a chance now to play our part in God's unfolding deliverance story right here, right now, 2016, Champaign-Urbana. Or someone else will be given that part while our lives ebb away. Spiritually, if we don't obey and follow God on this and really be a part of his justice. And practically, If there are random killings all around our country, actually they're not random, they're quite targeted. But if there continue to be these killings, what kind of country is it? This will affect us all. We'll be destroyed by injustice and fear and violence. And then Mordecai says, and this is really an important line, who knows? Perhaps you were made queen for such a time as this. And the question to us is, did God give you privilege in your personal or work or community circles for this very moment in time? Is this your Esther moment? Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go, gather all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day, and I also and my maidens will fast likewise. So we see that the first step is that prayer and supplication before the mighty God needs to undergird and lay the foundation for our bold action, which comes after. And then she says, so I will go on to the king. So an Esther moment is marked by some bold action. It means doing something. As we pray for each other, what we also do. Prayer isn't enough. That's not the Esther moment. The Esther moment is when she goes, which is not according to the law. So she was breaking some kind of law here. So what kind of spoken or unspoken rule or law will you have to break to do justly and to love mercy? It could be people don't talk about this at work, or that's not the kind of Facebook presence I have, or, you know, I don't want to look like the angry person. I don't want to be ostracized. What is the rule? You will have to break a rule to have an Esther moment. And then she says, and if I perish, I perish. That's costly. An Esther moment will cost you something. It may be big or small. It may be just discomfort, or it may be a strained relationship. But that's what it's going to take to save endangered lives right here in this country. Are you willing to risk safety and comforts to save the lives of our Black brothers and sisters? It's that real. And this opportunity is as real. So I'd love to take a moment of silent reflection for each of us to think, who is your circle? A circle of influence that you have, friends, could be a work circle, a community circle. Who do you interact with that you have influence over, that you might have privilege in a certain circle? Let's just each think about that for a moment. I hope you're able to pull up a small circle. The question we'll ask ourselves is, did God give you privilege in your personal work or community circle for this very moment? Could this be your Esther moment? And this matters because we're Christians and because God is a God of justice. And if we follow God, we have to follow his justice. And CCDA, the Christian Community Development Association, that we strongly support and we attend, they say it like this. They say, we believe that Black Lives Matter, both to us and to God. For us, this is a theological statement rooted in the Imago Dei, one that declares that all people are divinely endowed as image bearers of the Creator.
My hope is that as difficult and uncomfortable as this may be, you continue to reflect on this as we move back. We move to our time of communion. Continue to reflect on it today, this week, into the future as you continue to enter these different circles that God may have put you in for such a time as this. Once again, rather than seeming distant or disconnected, Jesus' story seems to relate quite easily to this one. That Jesus put himself at the end of that line that stretched all the way back to Abel. And Jesus was killed at the hands of an unjust religious political system, stood in as an innocent victim for many, whose mother stood by helpless to do anything about it, but who brought about resurrection so that we could follow in the same pattern, so that we could give whatever we are called to give on behalf of others, on behalf of those who have been oppressed, and so Jesus invites all of us to this table, no matter where we're coming from, no matter where we're at in this process. Jesus calls us to continue to be with him, to continue to open ourselves up to God as we continue on this journey. I'll say a short prayer for us, and then feel free to move to any of the tables around the back of the room to take communion. God, we've heard your call. We know that responding to your call will look different for each one of us as you continue to work individually in each of our lives. But we also know that we as a community can be present to support one another through these callings that each of us is receiving. Pray that we would follow in the example of Esther, and we could follow in the example of Jesus. And bring about your justice in the world. In Jesus' name, who made it possible for us to continue coming to you, we pray.